The Bounty of the Sea, in plant form. Seaweed is big business in Maine. 2 years ago, the state recorded its largest seaweed harvest. But as with any growing natural resource business, there are questions being raised about sustainability, about who really owns the sea floor where the plants grow, and about who has the right to harvest and protect it. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll learn more about seaweed, the products made from it, and the issues surrounding the industry. In the studio with me, Robin Hadlock Seeley, a marine ecologist and senior research associate at Cornell University's Shoals Marine Laboratory. Sean Mahoney, executive vice president and director of the Maine Conservation Law Foundation. And Andrew Bertacci, is founding president of the Maine Seaweed Council, which represents the interests of the industry. Of course, we want to hear from you as well. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Managing seaweed. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Chowonki. Honored to be profiled on the PBS documentary series Visionaries, airing on MPBN March 21st at 10 and March 23rd at 11. And by Endicott Home Furnishings in Scarborough, offering furniture without flame retardants for healthier living in small spaces. Learn more at condofurniture.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Growing up in the Mid-Coast, seaweed was something that we popped between our fingers or placed onto the head of our screaming sister while complimenting her nice hair. It was not something, however, that we put in our mouths and ate, and it certainly was not something that we thought had much value other than for maybe cooking a shore dinner in, doing a clam bake, if you will. Well, times have changed. There is real value in seaweed. And we thought today, we would start by exploring, what seaweed really is, the different types, the products that come from it, and then explore some of the issues that we raised at the top here about sustainability and about who has rights to this product and all of that. And we'll fit all of that in 45 minutes. But we thought we would start with Andrew Bertacci shaking his head. You don't think we can fit that in?
We can try.
Let's start with you, Andrew. Help us understand, give us a primer, if you will, an introduction to seaweed. I think of it as maybe what I think of as rockweed is what we always saw, washed up on the shore that you pop with your fingers. But there are really a number of different species, and they all have kind of different uses.
Certainly. There's no question that rockweed that you're speaking of is prominent. And we're all used to falling down on it and, it's
hunting
all,
for crabs.
It's olive green and it's all over the place. I grew up at Reed State Park in Georgetown and it was – half the day was the beach and half the day was the rockweed, just running around the rocks. But there are 10 more species that are harvested on the coast of Maine. And they are very, very different and almost need to be completely separated from the rockweeds in the way they are exploited. And I use that term in the absolute sense. Meaning used.
I remember, of course, kelp, which was used at marine colloids in Rockland, where my mother worked at one time, and that was processed and used even back in the 60s, 70s.
Right. Actually, that was Irish moss.
Oh, okay.
That was Irish moss. Carrageenan.
Yeah.
Is extracted from Irish moss.
Okay.
And that was an entire industry that – that developed young fishermen, young boys, mostly boys, because we're talking the 50s, 60s, they'd buy their first skiff by harvesting moss. They'd then grow up to a bigger boat and by harvesting moss, and then they would get their first lobster boat by harvesting moss. That's how they paid for their lives. When it became possible for marine colloids to buy Irish moss from Morocco, for instance, cheaper than they could harvest it here, we stopped being able to sell it here. And it stopped being harvested. And this is all very complicated, but then the urchins...
Well, I asked the
urchins,
question. You know.
The urchins ate it all.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
That's where the urchin industry came into this, because they completely expanded and they finished off the Irish moss, just mm-hmm. before the urchin divers finished them off.
So it's a real chain of
absolutely.
Predation.
No, everything is. Yeah. Everything is. And the point is, we then lost a whole generation of young moss harvesters. And when it came time that marine colloids said, we'd like to try some more Maine moss because it's very high quality, there was nobody to harvest it. I was asked to manage a harvest, and I looked around, and there were guys my age who were the only guys who remembered how to harvest moss and had the equipment.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But Robin Hadlock-Seely, so there are this variety of other species of sea plants that we call seaweed collectively. How have we discovered their value? Why have they suddenly become a product worth harvesting and making into products? Is this human ingenuity relatively recent?
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I don't work in the business of seaweeds, but... there's a certain segment of the industry, the health food industry, that seems to have discovered some of the health benefits of eating some of the other species of seaweed. And then this one species that we do spend a lot of time talking about, and that's because 90 to 95% of the seaweed landings in Maine are this seaweed called rockweed. So we do spend a lot of time talking about that species, which is Ascophyllum. But a lot of uses have been found for that particular species in products ranging from fertilizer to cattle feed supplements to extracts that you can put into meat that will make it stay red longer in the supermarket than it would ordinarily, to wrinkle cream, to high-end dog biscuits. So somehow this is a species that's found its way into multiple products. But in Maine, my understanding is mostly it's collected, it's mostly cut for the fertilizer and cattle feed supplement industry.
Sean Mahoney of the Conservation Law Foundation will visit briefly the sort of the conservation issue here, the sustainability issue. Is the problem mostly around rockweed or any of these that are being harvested?
Keith, our attention is focused on rockweed. And in large part, that's because of the role it plays in the greater scheme of things, in the greater ecosystem. I mean, we're environmental advocates, and part of what we focus on is what are the issues that affect the habitat that are critical to other parts of our ecosystem. So rockweed provides a critical nursery area for the keystone pieces of our marine economy. It's critical habitat for juvenile lobsters, and it's critical habitat for forage fish and for some ground fish. And our concern is that if we don't ensure that rockweed is harvested sustainably, we're going to lose the resource at a time when we can least afford to, given the challenges that are facing our ground fish industry, and our reliance on our lobster fishery. So our perspective is looking at the role that rockweed plays in the greater scheme of things.
All right, and we'll get much more into this and we'll take your calls as well. Again, the number 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Andrew Petrucci, before we get into this rockweed, before we get into the rockweeds. talk about some of the other products and species that we're talking about in terms of emergent seaweed industry apart from rockweed.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is where you make the differentiation between seaweed and sea vegetables. And sea vegetables are the greatest emerging fishery in the seaweeds. And those are things like nori, laver, dults, sea lettuce, the things that people buy at their health food store or at, for that matter, Hannaford or Shaw's, which are dehydrated and prepared. There's also, and they have, their economic value is huge. After the Japanese nuclear accident, sales for Maine Coast sea vegetables and Maine seaweeds in Franklin and Steuben rose to heights that they have not been able to fulfill the markets, and that is because of the iodine, which if you suffuse your body with natural iodine, then the radioactive iodine does not invade. But that's not really a big part of the industry. The last 2 years it has been.
And they're not big harvests as compared to rockweed, for example.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Nowhere near. 95% of the seaweed is that's harvested is rockweed.
And there's also grown seaweed. So
okay. Now, there's the most exciting piece, right. I think. We are now growing kelps. Now, kelps are seaweeds, but seaweeds are not kelps. And this has always been hard when I used to do programs for fourth graders.
I'm glad
graders.
We're going to a break.
Feels like it's, well, it's a Dr. Seuss book.
It goes on and on. But anyway, the kelps are being a whole new industry is starting with the culture of kelps by Ocean Approved in Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm. And they have developed a system for seeding lines and growing kelps in a permitted, controlled environment in the ocean, and providing a whole different kind of seaweed because they freeze their product. Pretty much everybody else dries it, and that's a whole different approach. And they can sell you kelp noodles, and they're pretty good.
It's also an industry where we don't need to worry about sustainability. We don't need to worry about huge impacts on the natural marine ecosystem. There's none of these other issues.
Are there issues about, though, who has the right to grow this? I assume this is grown on the sea floor, or is it grown
on ropes in the water, yeah. Actually.
Is that an issue? Who owns the property to do that? Or
no? I don't think so. In fact, Ocean Approved's site is, we're here in Portland. Ocean Approved site is 2 miles out into Casco Bay, and they've leased an area in Casco Bay that's demarcated, and that's where they grow their materials. And the only issue is whether or not the area that they're leasing has some other existing uses that are might compete with. And we've seen that before with salmon pens and the like. And in this case, Ocean Approved did a great job. Actually, the Conservation Law Foundation supported their lease because it's a great example of harnessing the natural resource, some real innovative technology, a great product. They make a great thing that goes well with a martini, and has some incredible potential for what it can do with respect to pharmaceuticals and the other breakdowns because of the characteristics of
kelp. So you all seem to be in agreement about this, the sort of the great potential of farmed seaweed.
Growing seaweed is really the way to go, not taking the natural populations.
I'll just play devil's advocate. It seems like rockweed is everywhere, and no matter how much you harvested, it would come. It would grow back, and you would never run out. Would you challenge me on that?
Well, here's an interesting difference between rockweed and kelp. We've been talking about growing kelp. The reason growing kelp works is because it grows about a centimeter a day. Rockweed, on the other hand, is a very slow-growing species. It grows at a rate between 3 and 16 centimeters a year. So we're really talking about extremely different growth rates. And that's one of the reasons we're so concerned about taking the naturally wild growing rockweed.
So is there a disagreement about limits that should be placed on rockweed, or lack of really agreement on much about how to even figure out what those limits should be, because we don't know?
I think that we have 80 to 90 years of history with a sustainable rockweed harvest in France, Ireland, Norway, Scotland, Iceland, Atlantic Canada, and Maine. Most of the early time in Europe, the more recent time, 42 years, right here in Maine. And the fisheries of, for instance, Iceland, which probably is the most prolific provider of rockweed resource in the world, the fisheries of Iceland cannot be challenged as to their efficacy for any reason, let alone the harvest of the rockweed.
Okay. We'll let you continue with that, and we'll get response from the other two who are itching to break in. First, though, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
He does a pretty good job bringing us the news every morning on Morning Edition, but how would host Erwin Gratz do if he was the opening announcer for a Portland Pirates hockey game? We're letting Erwin Gratz out of the Morning Edition hosting booth Friday evening so he can meet you at the Portland Pirates hockey game. It's no secret Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz has a thing for the New York Mets, but he likes hockey too. And this Friday, he'll be attending and doing the opening announcements for the Portland Pirates hockey game. To help celebrate the arrival of one of MPBN's newest radio programs, Only a Game with Bill Littlefield, MPBN is teaming up with the Portland Pirates for a special MPBN hockey night this Friday evening at 7 at the Cumberland County Civic Center as the Pirates take on the St. John Ice Caps. MPBN members can purchase tickets at a substantial discount of just $10 each, either from the Cumberland County Civic Center with your member card or online with a special code. For more information, visit mpbn.net and click on events. MPBN Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz will be the game opening announcer. We hope you can join us for this special Only a Game MPBN night with the Portland Pirates this Friday at 7. Thanks. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Portland Ovations, presenting the Pablo Ziegler Trio Nuevo Tango, March 28th at USM's Hannaford Hall, portlandovations.org, and by the law firm of Eaton Peabody, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and now Portland.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a look at Maine's seaweed industry. With me in the studio, Robin Hadlock Seeley. She's a marine ecologist. Sean Mahoney, executive vice president and director of the Maine Conservation Law Foundation. And Andrew Bertacci, founding president of the Maine Seaweed Council. We'd like you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Andrew Bertacci was making a case that other countries have demonstrated a degree of sustainability in the rockweed, in their rockweed industries. And I thought we would let Sean respond to that, and then Robin.
I think that's probably true, and I think Maine historically, you know, probably did have a fairly sustainable piece. The question for the harvesting goes to scope and scale, and when over the last decade or so, the demand for rockweed has increased, the methods for harvesting rockweed have changed, and so you have mechanical harvesting now, and so the issue really is not. From our perspective, is not one of whether or not you should be able to harvest it. We should be able to have a sustainable harvest. That's an important piece. The question is, what's sustainable, and how do you regulate that sustainability? And you know, the best available science now, and Robin can speak to that more, or Andrew. Has a floor at 16 inches. You need to leave 16 inches a holdfast, and that may not be enough. There's some new information that may not be enough. But if that's the standard for now, that's what you want to have. So it's not a question of saying you can't do it. It's a question, let's make sure we do it right so that we don't run into a situation like we did with urchins and just mow through them before they're gone. you know, so we don't run into a situation that we might face with elvers right now. You know, they're very high value to them, but are we harvesting ourselves out of an industry, and particularly with a resource that's got a lot of value for other sea critters? We need to be really careful with it, because if you fool around with Mother Nature, you know, you don't get a good result.
Robin?
A lot of people in Maine remember what happened to the urchin fishery when we went through kind of a boom and then a bust cycle. And, you know, those of us who are concerned about rockweed, you know, envision the same sort of thing happening. But a key difference that I want to point out is when Andrew speaks about a sustainable rockweed harvest, we have fundamental differences about what that word means, sustainable. When the seaweed harvesters talk about sustainability, they're really talking about biomass, how much they can cut, how much comes back, how long is it before they can come back and get the same yield again. When we talk, and when I say we, I'm the group that I'm part of, the Rockweed Coalition, when we talk about sustainability and questions of sustainability, we're really talking about ecological sustainability. In this day and age, it just doesn't work to look at species, one species at mm-hmm. a time, especially when you're looking at a species like rockweed that's at the base of the food web and supplies so many ecological services for 150 other organisms. You really have to look at it ecologically, not just in terms of plant biomass. And that's where the big data gap is. We don't know what's ecologically sustainable, and we have an industry that's increasing by leaps and bounds every year.
And I'll let you respond, Andrew, but I do want to understand how this is harvested. It's like a big I'm thinking of a Flowbee, which was that thing that was available only on TV.
I had a bad experience with one of those.
And cut it off. But is that kind of how is it?
I just today heard about this device. I'm not a big late night TV guy, and I really want to point out that when you talk about sustainable harvests, and we are now managing an elver harvest. Where basically we are authorizing a species to eat its own young. We are taking the young of an entire species and shipping them offshore. And so comparing the two are very different. Increasing by leaps and bounds, maybe 2.5% in the last 10 years. That might be considered leaps and bounds. I'm not sure. Mechanical harvest is very interesting because if one of your listeners were out on a rockweed bed and saw a hand harvester harvesting seaweed and a mechanical harvester, they would say, "Well, heck, the mechanical harvester's way gentler." And can't even take as much. I mean, a mechanical harvester can't trim off a boulder or something. It's got like a 10-inch nozzle that is drawing the fronds of rockweed into it. And you can't, you know, you do large areas, but you can't get in close to things. Whereas a mechanical, a hand harvester can, you know, pull everything he or she can find if they want to.
All right, let's get response, and then we're going to go to the phones.
I mean, a good analogy, I think, to place this in perspective is let's look at our ground fishery, right? We went through technological changes with how we catch fish so that our fishermen are far more effective. The gear that they have is more industrialized. It's a very different fishery than it was 50 years ago when, you know, you couldn't catch as much as quickly as you can today. And the results, you can see the results. We've caught more fish than is sustainable for a number of years. And combined with other environmental pieces, we've got a ground fishery that's in a total crisis. And the piece about rockweed is let's avoid that. Let's just make sure that the way we're doing this is appropriate. And that, I think, is what the three of us would share. The difference is, so what is that method?
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Lubeck and Robert. Hi, Robert.
Hello. I'm appreciating this good discussion that you're having there, I'd like to point out one thing, having listened to 4.5 hours of testimony in the State House yesterday on this issue. Rockweed harvesting abuse continues in Cobbs Cook Bay, even after safeguards were enacted in state law 4 years ago. Other parts of the state, there seems to be no inspection whatsoever about whether or not abuse occurs. Perhaps it does, perhaps not. Certainly not every harvester, not every processor, but it's likely that abuse of the resource may continue. My question for discussion to you and the panelists is, if a management plan for statewide seaweed is developed, who enforces it? More particularly, who pays for enforcement of it every year? The state is broke. Could be a significant cost every year to enforce a management plan like that, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, I would guess.
Yeah, it's a good question. In particular, how do you inspect the ocean floor also? I mean, that's it's harder than stopping by the local farm. Yeah, Andrew?
Well, I'd like to say that I'd rather have a plan in place that it is difficult for us to enforce than no plan in place. And this is where the Cobbs Cook plan and the full state plan come into controversy, because we want and have for 20 years, we've wanted a full state plan for the management of all 11, 12 seaweed species. And you can't very well say that since we can't pay for more regulation, we shouldn't develop more regulation. I mean, we need to aspire to that.
Yeah, Robin.
But that's exactly what we do say, that having a seaweed management plan for the entire state where you have well-intentioned regulations, but you can't afford to actually manage it. Because managing a plant, and seaweeds are not plants, but for the point of discussion, a plant. Managing a plant industry different from a fishery, it's really different. It's area-based. It takes a lot more management simply because it is area-based, a lot more inspection, a lot more enforcement. Having a plan that has good intentions but is underfunded, to me, would be worse than admitting that you can't do it.
Right, but I would have to say the rockweed allows more inspection because it's stationary. And that's different from a fishery. The fishery, it's very difficult to manage to evaluate. A rockweed harvest, you can evaluate 15 minutes after it's done.
Isn't it in the interest of the industry also, though, to make sure that they just don't run out? I mean, this is the same way that with urchin, that happened with urchins. But, you know, the lobstering industry seems to be able to do this.
I was just going to say that, Keith. The point is a good one. The state is stretched for resources. You don't want to put new responsibilities on agencies like the Department of Marine Resources, which has a lot of coasts to cover. But, you know, these plans are useful in both requiring some measure of self-regulation. You have to develop a plan. You have to say where you're going to harvest. You have to say how much you're going to harvest. It allows people to go back and check, or it allows somebody to say, well, this person harvested here and look at the results. It's not good. That's an important piece of it. There's an education component of it for the industry itself. And I do think that the lobster industry, having lobster zones, that could be a very good model for the state to follow. I think the other piece of this is that what is unresolved, and one of the reasons why, you know, a group of environmental lawyers like Conservation Law Foundation are engaged, is there's a legal question here too with respect to what are the rights that shore landowners might have as opposed to wide open access to the areas where you harvest rockweed, which is the intertidal area.
Yeah. So how do you – are you allowed to take your boat and your harvester and sort of float over to my expensive waterfront property and just harvest what's right there in front of me? Or what's the
– Well, I mean, I guess the first part is it's all waterfront areas, right? So it's there's a lot of land trusts that own it. There's a lot of municipal lands and the like. But the law is – and it's fairly unique to Maine and Massachusetts – is that access to the intertidal zone is open to the public for the purposes of fishing, fouling, and navigating. And that's been an issue that the courts in Maine have struggled with for over 150 years. There's been some recent case law about it, one concerning a beach in southern Maine, one concerning the right to access for scuba diving up in down east, and it's an issue. It's our position that the law currently is that the shoreland owners do have they have the right to control access to the intertidal area for the purposes of harvesting rockweed, because rockweed harvesting is not fishing, it's not fouling, and it's not navigating. And there's obviously some competing interpretations of that. But
okay, we got to take a break. Andrew, I'll let you go, but we got to take a break. We'll be right back. We'll take more of your calls. You're listening to Maine Calling. Stay with us.
Intelligence Squared U.S., where the world's leading thinkers debate today's critical issues. The next topic up for debate, does America need a strong dollar?
For the most part, yes, it's a good thing.
Basically, a weak dollar hurts those who buy imports, whether it's wine or cars from Japan.
The dollar has been greatly overvalued.
But it helps those who export.
Join us for Intelligence Squared immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock. As you know, many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting MPBN, either on MPBN radio or MPBN television, visit our webpage, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information, or give us a call at 800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
We would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. Thank you, Ringo. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program. We're talking about seaweed. With me in the studio, Robin Hadlock Seely, a senior research associate with Shoals Marine Laboratory, Sean Mahoney, he's Executive Vice President and Director of the Maine Conservation Law Foundation, and Andrew Bertacci, he's Founding President of the Maine Seaweed Council. Join the conversation. What do you want to know about our state seaweed industry? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, email talk at mpbn.net, post to our Facebook page, or tweet at Maine Calling. Before we go to the phones, Andrew, I promised you could respond to what was said about...
Very quickly, from the revised Maine statutes, definitions of terms, Maine declares it owns and shall control the harvesting of living resources of the seas. Marine resources means all renewable marine organisms. Marine organism means any animal, plant, or other life that inhabits water below the head of tide. Fish, the verb, means to take or attempt to take any marine organism by any method or mean. Conservation means providing for the development and wise utilization of the marine resource, protecting the supply, and implementing sound management programs. The public trust rights in the intertidal land include the right to use the intertidal land for fishing, fouling, and navigation. And fishing is a verb which is called out in Maine statute, which means to take or attempt to take any marine organism by any method.
And I guess they are organisms.
Let's
go to Monroe and Betsy. Hi, Betsy. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. My comment is, why is it so hard for human beings to accept the fact that there are some things that they've got to keep their hands off? This rockweed is like the placenta of the ocean. It's the... one necessary organism for the entire fishery to thrive, and for at least 50 to 100 separate species to live. This is like the marine parade of life, and without this rockweed, the fishery will collapse.
Robin, you were making this case earlier. Do you want to?
Yes, it's not a hypothetical. For example, we know that the rockweed cutting activity takes bycatch with it. One of the things that it takes with it is the common periwinkle. Common periwinkle is the foundation of a very important fishery in Downeast Maine called locally the wrinkle fishery. So we have people desperately trying to make a living in Downeast Maine collecting wrinkles or common periwinkles. Meanwhile, the rockweed cutters are taking wrinkles as bycatch, but without having to have a wrinkle license. So it's not theoretical. It's very concrete.
Andrew?
Yes. The particular periwinkle that we're speaking about here is an invasive species that does have a value as a fishery, and that's great for people who can fish them. But they do not live on the rockweed. They live on the substrate, on the rock. The local species of periwinkles do occasionally graze or often graze on the rockweed. But the species that we're speaking about, which is of economic benefit to the hardworking people of Coquitlam Bay, lives on the rock, not on the rockweed.
No, it's not correct. DMR actually helped fund a study in Copscook Bay in 2009, and there's actually data in their reports on how many of the common periwinkles are actually taken with the rockweed.
Okay, well, we've got a disagreement there.
That's fine. I'm not going to solve it.
Got a few more of those.
You're not looking to the lawyer to solve it, are you?
No. We'll go to Mount Vernon and Evie. Hi, Evie. Is it Evie or Evie? I'm sorry.
Oh.
Yes. Is it Evie or Evie? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh.
There you go.
State of Maine, is dulse being harvested?
I think her question is dulse being harvested? Yes, and I think we talked about that.
Absolutely. Larch Hansen at Maine Seaweeds and Shep Earhart at Maine Coast Sea Vegetables and several others, and I apologize to the others whose names I can't pull up right now, are producing a great deal of dulse. It is probably the most beautiful marine species in the world, as far as I'm concerned. Looking at a dulse plant growing in the Damariscotta River on a ledge surrounded by sea lettuce is the most beautiful thing you could ever see.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, but I noticed what she was asking, and it was, are there seaweeds that are edible that you can pick while you're just sort of walking along the shore? And how do you learn about that, or what's a good source to figure out sort of what those plants look like? And
You can get a Maine Seaweed Council guide to seaweeds of the coast of Maine. You can that's probably the quickest way to find out. But yes, they're everywhere. Every citizen of the state of Maine is authorized to harvest up to 50 pounds of seaweed per day.
Wow.
For personal use.
With the permission of the landowner, of course.
Sure.
I don't blame you for doing that.
What would most people then, 50 pounds of what? They wouldn't take 50 pounds of rockweed, or would they for a clam bake or something, you mean?
Sure. Or to put on their garden. That's right.
It's fertilizer.
They'd be hard-pressed to find 50 pounds of dulse without, you know, working really hard. Most of the other species, except for the kelps, which, as I said, are a different sort of family, but they're all seaweeds. You would have a hard time because they're small plants. You know, they're the size of the palm of your hand plants.
Let's go to Bangor and Alex. Hi, Alex.
Yep.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm just curious about what's being done to help the edible seaweed producers in Maine have access to the market in South Asia. I do research at the university on the radioactivity of the seaweed, and in particular the seaweed in the Gulf of Maine, and I can say that it's uncontaminated here, and that should be a major selling point in the future.
You addressed this earlier.
As I said earlier, our sea vegetable providers have been overwhelmed for 2 years with these orders, and they are unable to fulfill them because they have been for 40 years sustainably harvesting these. So they refuse to harvest more than they should.
Can rockweed be farmed? Or you were saying it's very slow growing.
Yes, I've asked some of the industry representatives about this, and they say it grows too slowly to be any use as a farmed species. However, I have to say I've been in the intertidal and found mooring lines that have been abandoned and found a really nice growth of rockweed growing on that rope. Of course, I don't know how many years it took to achieve that growth, but my understanding is it grows too slowly to be a good farmed species.
Let's go to York. And is it Turbert?
Yes. Down here in York, we're having an invasion of what is supposedly from Japan that came out of ballast waters from shipping, a very small, granular, like smaller than Irish moss seaweed. And it's supposedly very, not just invasive, but super rapid growing and tends to blanket and overcome the local ecology of seaweed. I wonder what your guests would have to say about this, and is there any economic possibility of using it, and what kind of a threat does it really play here? Because it's moving north.
Yeah, Robin, we'll start with you and then Andrew.
Yeah, that invasive species was actually first sighted in Maine at the Shoals Marine Laboratory on Appledore Island. Some of our underwater classes found it. This invasive is a real problem. It reproduces rapidly. There's some reports that it clogs lobster traps. I myself have found it deep, covering rockweed in a layer when it drifts up and dries. It's a real problem, and I know Andrew wanted to chip in on this.
You got about a minute. Andrew.
No, well, everybody agrees that this is Heterosiphonia japonica. Not that anybody really needs to know that, but it is a red filamentous algae, and it is going to be a problem in rockweed beds, on beaches, in many parts of Maine very soon.
And Keith, if I could just add, I mean, that speaks to a bigger issue of what you do with ballast water. And again, it's one of these things that everything has an impact. If we're not careful about regulating where ballast water gets discharged, particularly as we're bringing in new types of ships or bigger ships into our coastline, we run the risk of just this situation that Turbert just talked about.
And with that, that's the final word. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Hadlock-Seeley, marine ecologist and senior research associate at Shoals Marine Laboratory, which is jointly operated by Cornell University and the University of New Hampshire. Sean Mahoney, Executive Vice President and Director of the Maine Conservation Law Foundation. And Andrew Bertocci is the founding president of the Maine Seaweed Council. Today's program was produced by our volunteer Scott McAuliffe and by Jonathan Smith. Scott also answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.